Today's episode of the Glass Half Empty podcast is brought to you by Kingsford Charcoal. Baseball season may be winding down, but there is no off season when it comes to firing up the grill. Stay stoked all year. And be sure to check out Kingsford's hilarious new video featuring the immortal Bartolo Colon on Twitter, at Kingsford.
Rogers in trouble. It's going to get there. He turned 32 yesterday. Does he have a vintage moment in it? In the end zone, it is caught for the win. Richard Rogers with a walk-off touchdown. A game ender for the Packers.
Welcome to the Glass Half Empty podcast on the Big Lead. We are joined by Bob Seibin of SportsTVRatings.com. Bob has a podcast with Jemele Hill coming out over the weekend that you should listen to after you listen to this one. And Pat Crakes is a former Fox Sports executive who is now a sports media consultant. Guys, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me, Ryan.
Doing great. Good to be here.
Cool. So, to the surprise of absolutely nobody who dared click on this, we are going to start with NFL TV ratings. So, Bob has done a chart running every week, which he is saying how the networks are doing versus last year. This year, he has NBC up 2%, Fox up 2%, CBS up 6%, ESPN down 3%. NFL Network up 2% for a net 3% gain. Bob, what is your big takeaway from this table so far?
Just want to note that those numbers don't include the Thursday night Giants. Who did they get crushed by last night?
The Eagles. They're Super Bowl
Eagles,
contenders now.
Yeah. So those numbers are only through week five. My big takeaway is that the numbers have stabilized and they stabilized better than I thought they would. I mean, I had been predicting that they would go down another 5% or so, and so that they're up even a little bit is a good story, especially given the overall sort of broadcast TV landscape this fall. Which, the broadcast TV networks have been getting hit for years and years and years. It's a 30 plus year thing. But lately it's been a little bit worse. And so the NFL, even though it's still, it's still probably down 15% or so versus a couple of years ago relative to the field, it's never looked better. And it is in a very strong position. And it's tough for people to, I think, put their arms around that, even in an environment where the NFL's ratings are down from the highs, the NFL is actually in a stronger position than it's been in, when it was at its highs 2 years ago.
Pat, quick question. You've studied this stuff a lot over the years. Do you think that the NFL might have front-loaded some of the most exciting games on the schedule to start the season with a good ratings narrative, or do you think that the modest growth has been more organic than that strategy would suggest?
Well, I think that the NFL does a really good job of trying to figure out how to strategically place games across the schedule. And of course you want to start out strong, and that's always part of the strategy. So, over the past couple of years, they were trying to get that done too. So, give them a lot of credit for figuring out how to manage a schedule, not just, I think, at the beginning of the season, but also on the tail end. And I think it's hard to look at the schedule and say that it's really front-loaded. I also don't know that I agree with Robert. I think that we're looking at some stabilization here, and that's a positive thing in the context of everything else. We still have a lot of weeks to go. And, great example of how unpredictable this can be, if we have stabilized, is the matchups are going to determine small amounts of growth or declines, right? So last night's matchup, when they put it up on paper, they figured it was early enough in the season. This is an NFC matchup. It's going to have New York and Philadelphia. Even if it's subpar, it will do well. right? But, you know, situation on the field changes a lot. Giants are really struggling, and, you know, you get a game that in some cases didn't look very, you know, it didn't look very competitive. But so that's where they're at now, and you kind of want it to be in the hands of the games, right? But you can draw these matchups the best you want, try to be as strategic as possible. But the truth of the matter is that the quality of the game dictates a lot of this within reason. And I do think that we've seen some stabilization here, but we do have a long way to go.
So there were two pieces. Well, there have been four pieces that I want to talk about, but two of them kind of contradicted each other. There was a piece in USA Today that essentially concluded that it was not protests that harmed NFL ratings. It was bad football. But the Wall Street Journal wrote this week that part of the spotlight on the protests has gone down, and I don't even think it's total speculation that they say that that's one of the reasons that the ratings are up a little bit. Troy Vincent brought it up in that Wall Street Journal piece. And then they also wrote that a growing number of viewers over 50 years old are watching the NFL this season, according to Nielsen. People over 50 view player protests during the national anthem, which have become more muted this season, more negatively than the general population. So I think that the Wall Street Journal seems to think that the protests were a bigger deal in the declines over the last 2 to 3 years than USA Today's data, which came from Comscore, indicates. Pat, first, how do you view the differences in these two stories?
Well, the real temptation here is to always take a look at something that's right in front of your face, that's visible, and have it explain something that's happening next to you. And, it's really hard for me to say that there's any kind of correlation between that and the ratings declines. I think from an analytic perspective, the ratings declines were largely driven by increased competition from news and other outlets. I think they sucked off viewers. And I think one of the things that's happened this season is the news cycle isn't any less vicious, but viewers are beginning to learn how to compensate for it. And I base that simply upon the fact that the NFL was reaching as many people as it always had in past seasons, but they were watching for lower lengths of tune, right? But usage and consumption of news was way up. That's the primary explanation. Are there secondary or tertiary explanations that add small bits and pieces to something that was already a bigger trend and maybe pile on at the end? Sure. But at the end of the day, I think it's largely explained by a change in impact in the viewing environment that I think has done a permanent shift. I don't think news is going to get any less interesting to people. But I think the viewers are beginning to adjust to it, and that's why you're seeing some of the stabilization.
Bob, what do you think about that?
I tend to agree with Patrick right down the line there. I mean, I had a couple of people reach out to me to talk about that USA Today story on the protests not mattering. And, you know, what I told them is I'm happy to talk about the NFL ratings and what they're doing. I don't really want to talk about why they're doing what they're doing, because I don't really know, and nobody else really knows either. And, that kind of thing is, I think, just an exercise that people do to while the time away. I don't think it really gets to anything.
Well,
Ryan, what I'll add is that if the protests were somehow impacting the ratings for the NFL, other sports that are either more overtly patriotic or may have some kind of controversy like that also occurring inside of it aren't behaving the same way the NFL does. So it's very hard for me to say there's any kind of analytical reason to support that argument, right? Now, you can make a bigger case that says the brand over the long term may be somehow impacted by that, right? But that's a long term, very intangible way. Rubber doesn't meet the road on a week to week basis. So I just wanted to toss that in there.
I believe, go ahead.
So I was just going to say, so, you know, for me, just as kind of as a data guy, there's not really any difference between 3% up and 3% down. I mean, I really see that as, you know, kind of the same thing in the same range. But there is a big difference. And the big difference, I think, is this. if it was 3% down instead of 3% up, the narrative right now and the presidential tweeting and all the other stuff might be very different than it is. But the numbers wouldn't be very different. They would still be very much the same, but the narrative would be very different.
I would dispute that the protesting has become more muted because Kaepernick was gone last year. And this year, Kenny Stills knelt for the anthem. Michael Bennett protested the anthem on the defending Super Bowl champion Eagles. The Panthers went and signed Eric Reed in the middle of like a Kavanaugh firestorm, and he protested the anthem during the anthem. I don't want to say protested the anthem. I mean protested during the anthem last week. So I would argue that about as many players this year as last year are protesting during it. So I would dispute the idea that it's been muted. But one thing that I believe that I brought up the last time we talked was that these young quarterbacks had, this is before the season, I said that we need, Baker Mayfield and Sam Darnold, Josh Rosen, and Josh Allen to get out there. And they've come out, and I think as a group, exceeded expectations. And I didn't even see Patrick Mahomes, who thus far in his short career could be, the greatest of all time, coming. So I think that the infusement of young talent, not to mention the fact that no real star quarterbacks have been hurt so far this year, has also played a lot into the moderate bounce. And that was something that a lot of the network executives spoke about in a piece with John Oran that my mind is hazy, but it either ran last week or this week. And in my opinion, seemed to trigger a whole bunch of different stories about where we're at with NFL ratings. What do you think about that, Bob?
So first of all, I just want to get back to the idea, your comment that the kneeling itself isn't more muted this year. Something I like to see, and maybe you guys subscribe. I mean, there are database services you can kind of look this up on. But how much press is there per kneeling this year versus last year? I think that might be what's muted. Like ESPN might be covering it less, and even the websites might be covering it less.
It's way less. There was that former army person. I forget his name off the top of my head, but do you remember when he was upset that MSNBC canceled his spot because the kneeling just wasn't getting resonance and wasn't front page news anymore?
Yeah. So I think both things can be true, that the muting isn't more muted than it was last year, but the coverage of the muting is, and I think that, if it's the latter, that's very interesting, and that certainly works to the NFL's benefit. As for the exciting new QBs and people staying healthy, I like it, and I it's nice to have these stories, and I think it generates good press, but I don't really know how much impact, if any, that's having on the ratings.
What do you think, Pat?
I think stars and quarterback play have an impact. And I think the games have been exciting. You've had some fun stories. I mean, Baker Mayfield / Cleveland is a fun story, right? And so this all kind of creates a positive ecosystem. I want to really, I do think that the fact that Thursday Night Football and some other things have kind of been sorted out. I mean, Fox has really put a lot of resources into that. They've despite the quality of some of the games that they've had, I think that they've done a great job both starting the beginning of the season when they were producing NFL Network's games and now their own games in addition to NFL Network. I think that both them having the flag planted on Thursday and really embracing and wanting to own that package, and then the league finding a way to finally really, I think, schedule for Thursday across the board is really also having an impact as well. I just think for a couple of years, a couple of things broke the wrong way. Now some things are breaking the right way. And you throw into the fact that you can make too much of the media fractionalization in the context that people are going to watch compelling stuff live. And I think you're seeing that come out with the NFL because it's got the most compelling content probably right now in the media business.
You mentioned Fox putting a bunch of resources into Thursday night. So I watched that game And there's a sponsor for everything. It's McDonald's for the pregame. It's Toyota for halftime. It's Buffalo Wild Wings for the postgame. Is there some sort of like ballpark figure you can give for how much money Fox gets in extra sponsorship versus what CBS and NBC were pulling in last year for Thursday Night Football? Because I can't remember like this many different segments of the program being sponsored directly like they are.
Well, I think, you know, I'm not going to put a ballpark on it, but it's probably in the tens of millions easily. But, you know, Fox has got a cogent strategy, right? CBS and NBC were doing a great job, but in some ways, the package didn't always work for them in the context of their strategy. Fox has a cogent strategy now revolving completely around live sporting events and news and some entertainment programming on the broadcast television network. So when their sales force goes out to the marketplace, Thursday Night Football is being sold in conjunction with lots of other live sporting events and programs across the network. So it all works together to create an advertising, an ecosystem for advertisers. If you're McDonald's and you're advertising in a Big Ten college football game, there may be a reason or a way to lever you into Sunday football, into Thursday Night Football. And it's just a force multiplier. And they've done a great job of creating integrations, I think. I mean, last night I was laughing watching Joe and Troy, and those McDonald's golden arches were up there like a flashing beacon. And I'm thinking to myself, I really like that. That's awesome. And so they've done a great job, Ryan, of finding creative ways to integrate. They had the Tide commercial last night with Joe and Troy. It was kind of fun. And I think it's all working, but it's made possible by a change in strategy, or a better word would be Thursday Night Football better fits for the Fox strategy. Their ad sales force is optimized to look to do this, not just on Thursday night, but across the board and sell the portfolio. Remember, they have an own the fall strategy. It's largely around football and baseball postseason. So I think that's what you're seeing. You're seeing the results of a strategy being executed upon and an entire company organized around that. And at the end of the day, it's worth tens of millions.
You know who didn't love the McDonald's golden arches flashing is Bob. Bob, do you want to get on to your soapbox now and do your thing about sports sponsorship and obesity?
It's not really a soapbox about sports sponsorship. It's more about advertising. So it's just interesting to me that, you know, the sales community that handles all the sponsorships is really upbeat. But they don't ever want to deal with any of the stories that come out that say, you know, 80% of sports sponsorship is fast food. And, you know, so the soapbox is really only motivated by, you know, pretty much what seems like once a month stories coming out that, you know, obesity or America's weight problem or however it's framed is worse than it's ever been. Once a month when I see those stories, I usually do tweet something about sports sponsorships. But I don't really have it in for McDonald's.
Okay, so
you know who else didn't like that McDonald's Golden Arches sponsorship with Joe and Troy?
I'm gonna
Wendy's
guess Phil Mustang.
Burger King.
Wendy's and Burger King hated that.
I guess so. So I wanted to switch a little bit and talk about USA Today. I don't want to be too mean because they're our parent company, but they put out a piece that I reflexively disagree with the premise of where they said they put it out today and they said that people who are concerned about the NFL as the dying sport, they should be concerned about baseball. And this almost feels like a Mad Libs story to me in the sense that we keep hearing that the youth aren't watching baseball and that national viewership is declining. But look, I'm in the Midwest, so I'm biased because when I go to Cubs games or when I go to Brewers games, they have very vibrant scenes. Even the White Sox, who are very bad and have been very bad for several years now, they draw an enthusiastic, if not massive, audience. And I keep seeing the regional ratings numbers about how the baseball teams are beating like whatever you think is like the highest rated sitcom or drama. Baseball teams are beating those in their markets. And I just don't see the cause for concern that media outlets keep seeing in MLB. Pat, what's your thoughts on that?
Well, look, as long as I've been in the media business, which started, you know, back in the 90s, I've been hearing this narrative about baseball is going to die because young people don't interact with it, and the ratings are declining. And the ratings decline stories are usually have to do with national telecast windows. But the truth of the matter is that if you take a look at all the regional ratings and all the national ratings over the regular season and do some kind of reach study, you're going to find that baseball reaches more people than it ever has before. It's in more places. It's more accessible. It makes more money and is more relevant than it ever has been in the past. Its reach is enormous. Like you said, Ryan, the St. Louis Cardinals on Fox Sports Midwest in primetime are going to outrate on a Tuesday night the combined gross rating points of the broadcast television networks. They're going to do that. And that story extends to places like Cincinnati, where the Reds have been in the cellar for 4 or 5 years and they have the fourth best ratings in all of baseball. So I'm a little mystified by it. And the comparison set to the NFL, which is its own unique beast and has been for 30, 40 years, there's really nothing that compares to that. One of the great stories about baseball is if you take a look like in 1972 at the top 10 shows in primetime, you're going to have a Ryan Glass Spiegel favorite like Mannix up there at the top. And the World Series is also going to be a top 10 show. This year, when the top 10 programs on broadcast television and television are run, right, in the top 10 will be a whole bunch of different sets of new shows that didn't exist 30 or 40 years ago. But guess what will be there? The World Series will still be there. So as far as comparing to the right relevant set, baseball is as competitive as it ever was. Just the media landscape has changed enormously. So I didn't really understand it, but I've heard it before. And I'll also touch on this whole idea that young people don't watch, so therefore they won't watch in the future. First of all, cautionary tale. What you think kids are doing today is not directly predictive of what they're going to do in 30 years. They're going to change. Everybody changes as they get older. And some things are different, but some things stay the same. And baseball, according to some of the research we did 10 or 15 years ago when I was at Fox, is a sport that you interact with when you're very young and then come back to after you have your own family. And I think that if any of these narratives in the 90s were correct, baseball shouldn't have any ratings today. Yet we just talked about, when I went off on this long soliloquy, how baseball reaches more people than ever before. So I just think when you objectively look at it, it's not a very, very cogent. It's not correct at all. And that's one of the reasons why baseball is going to do very, very well in this next round of media negotiations, which are coming up. I think baseball is an enormously valuable property, and I think it's just fine.
Well, I would say that the baseball playoffs are an enormously valuable property, but the Sunday night and Wednesday night package, I know there's not like a whole lot of other things going on during a lot of the season, and they're a proverbial innings eater for ESPN. But I don't know, the viewership on those games, I'd be a little bit concerned about them going forward. What are your thoughts on baseball and the media narrative and all of that, Bob?
So first of all, I don't know about you, Ryan, but I was a big Mannix fan back in the day. I think Ryan's probably a little bit too young for
Mannix. I don't know what that is.
look, Google it after we get off. So
are you talking about Chris Mannix, the guy from Yahoo? He doesn't have a top 10 rated show.
No. Mannix was a police detective TV show in the early 1970s, maybe like 60s too. I agree. So your comment was it looked like a Mad Lib story to you, and Pat and I kind of had some back and forth on Twitter, pretty much saying the same thing. So as far as the USA Today story goes, I didn't really get it. As far as ESPN's interest or any other sports network's interest in the national MLB packages, I think that they're gonna stay with the toe dipped in somehow. So, you know, ESPN wants that home run derby. It wants the one wild card game, and it's sort of the same thing over Turner. And Turner's Sunday games aren't even exclusive, but you know, they buy into their package largely, so they get the postseason. And I think that environment that made that attractive. You know, the last time around, it's going to still make it attractive. I don't know if the players are going to be the same players, but I don't expect the money to go down.
Yeah. Let me just add one thing. I mean, when it comes to investing in national windows, you are kind of either investing in the postseason or you're doing what ESPN does. You know, they pay a lot for an exclusive national window on Sunday nights, only true exclusive national window that's actually monetized that way. They have that on Sunday night, and baseball is a sport that distribution partners will pay you for, right? And they pay you for it because people want to watch baseball. And just I'll add to the whole idea of baseball's value and baseball's relevance. I mean, the Fox RSNs were a big part of the Disney acquisition. Disney has to sell them off. In the next couple of weeks or months, we're going to learn who's going to buy them. They're buying access to baseball games. Those baseball games drive a significant portion of the $30 billion Disney's probably going to get for the Fox RSNs and the resale. And I'll add one last thing. Christine did touch on the attendance issues this year. Some of that was weather. There probably are in the experiential economy some things about the experience at the stadium from the second you leave the door of your house to when you return. That all sports need to be thinking about, right?
Yeah, college football too. She could have written that about college football.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, in an age when people are trading assets for experiences, and you can see it certainly in music, and I've seen it the past couple of years in music, you understand the power of experiences and live events. I think that's something they need to pay attention to. But, you know, anybody who wants to really understand kind of attendance analysis, I think Mari Brown has done a great job of covering that this year. And I think most of it's probably weather at the beginning of the year, but there are aspects of the experiential economy that I think all sports need to address, baseball included.
Well, I don't know. Like I said, I've been going to games in Chicago and Milwaukee. I see lots of kids at these games, and I see people very happy with their experience, but I get that it might be different in markets where there is a lot to do in Chicago, but in markets where, I don't know, like California or something like that, like the A's, they're not drawing anybody, for example. And I think that this is the attendance thing is more of a regional issue than it's been made to seem like, as opposed to being an across the board issue.
Yeah, I think you're probably right.
Go ahead.
What do you think, Bob?
So I was just going to say, I actually think that the venue problem is an ongoing problem. It's going to be a problem for everyone, and I expect it will even ultimately get down to being a problem for the smaller venues, you know, like basketball and NHL as well. I think they have a big challenge on their hand. It's multiplied. So the first big challenge is it's really good to watch games at home on an HDTV. And the second challenge is all the other stuff that it's competing with. And I think that's going to get squeezed more and more and more, and venues are going to have more and more pressure on them.
So what do we think is going to happen then? Venues become smaller, or are they going to become these like kind of tech hubs where you go there and they try to integrate your screens into the experience? Or like, Pat, how are they going to solve this issue? Which, again, I don't think is just a baseball issue.
It's not. It's a trend. And I think it's tied to the experiential economy. Like I said before, I think Bob's right. I think you're right. Some regions have bigger problems than others. I think the answer is all the above, right? The experience has to be really, really high quality. So there needs to be a rethink across the board about what you're doing to make people get into the stadium. For years, we used to test the value of going to the game or watching a game at home. And what we heard was the thing that a broadcaster can do is make a fan feel like they're at the game. And everybody always said, you know, 7 out of 10 people would say, I want to go to the game. I got to be at the game. But if I can't be at the game, I want to feel like I'm at the game. Sometime about 2009, that flipped. And the majority of people said, you know, going to the game's kind of hard. And thanks to high-definition television and Dolby surround sound, these broadcasters are doing a great job making me feel like I'm at the game. And so Bob's insights into the competition from in-home is really, really salient because it's only going to become even more intensely terrific inside the home as we move forward. And so to get people out to come and pay to go to the games, teams are going to have to take a real effort and think through what the touch points are. It's not dissimilar, but it's not the same to what retail is going through. And it's kind of resurrection renaissance to turn shopping into more experiences, right? And learning how to use the online experience and the app side experience as complementary and as force multipliers as opposed to competitive. So it's a real challenge. I don't think they really understand it yet. I don't think they do. I think retail clearly understands it because you see the changes. But I don't think sports venues understand it as a whole. I think some do, right? There's some people like the Atlanta MLS team is I think, you know, they're doing some interesting things. I think it's happening. But it's a real challenge, and the competition from inside the home is only going to get more intense. So getting them out is going to require a really unique experience.
Well, we see like Nick Saban bashing the Alabama students because they don't want to go to an 11 a.m. kickoff against Cupcake U when Alabama is going to like be up 21-0 5 minutes into the game and doesn't have like any introspection about how maybe he should schedule programs that are more enticing for the student body to go out and leave their house and see. And so to your point about like how they're going to have to like adjust the experience, I think there are some venues that do a great job of it where it, like if you go, I keep bringing up Milwaukee, but if you go to a Brewers game, you really feel like you're a part of something, that you can go there 3 hours early with your family, like fire up the grill and tailgate and not have to spend $80 or $120 on concessions inside the building. And then there's like a very like fervent energy. So I don't know how you, if you don't have someone like Derek Jeter to give you the MVP and synthesize this energy, like I don't think all 30 teams can do that, but that there are like, if you make the games feel like they're experiential and worth leaving the house for, then I think that the best venues in sports still do a great job of that.
I don't disagree. And I think it's what makes it hard is that there's a general, you know, understanding, then there's your particular market's understanding, right? So, you know, what the A's need to do is probably different than what the Brewers need to do. So it's a challenge, but it's there. And if they want to fill the stadiums, it's going to become an increasingly larger challenge because
well,
they're not just competing
with
the in-home experience, they're competing with everything else.
I hope it becomes an increasingly large problem for these people because I love going to the games and I'd love it to be less expensive. So we'll move on from there. Bob, your friend Rich Greenfield hypothesized that Amazon could come in with like a $3 billion offer and just blow everybody else out of the water for Monday Night Football. We keep hearing about these streaming companies that they're going to come in, but every time these like rights come up, the real premium ones go to the legacy networks. What do you think about the idea of Amazon coming in with just like an offer the NFL can't refuse?
So first of all, I think it's important to understand, you know, Rich has an agenda, and the agenda is he wants everything disrupted because it entertains him, and that's fine, but Rich is more interested in this than Amazon is. And you have to ask yourself the question, why is Rich more interested in it than Amazon is? And who's smarter? And I think Amazon is probably smarter here. I think both sides. So from the NFL's perspective, it's not necessarily, even if Amazon comes with a truckload of money, it's not necessarily in their best interest to just take the money. And it's certainly not in Amazon's best interest to just hand the money out and set it on fire just because they can. Right now, given the current technology and given the way people currently use the internet and given how all the Twitter and Verizon and Yahoo and Oath, whatever that's called now, and how the NFL packages streaming is going, isn't that much. People, it's still not that. I mean, it's way, way up, and it's still a tiny percentage of the overall consumption. Given that, I would be very surprised if Amazon did much more than it's doing now in the next package.
What do you think, Pat?
Well, so first of all, Rich is eventually going to be right if he makes enough predictions. I think that's his strategy.
That's what futurists do.
Yeah, and wasn't it like 18 months ago he was talking about Amazon should buy the entire NFL or something. And also on top of that, we had Disney should abandon all of its linear content. Just get out of the TV.
And buy Twitter.
But that said, Rich is a very, very smart guy, and so he comes up with these scenarios, and they're worth thinking about. From my perspective, I just want to say before I go into this that I am in no way attached to the Kingsford direct-to-consumer streaming business or the McDonald's purchase or bid of the RSNs. I just want to let that go before I say this.
Wait a minute. So Kingsford, I got to sing the praises of Kingsford because they're supporting Ryan and his video stuff on Twitter.
Right.
And this podcast.
This is going to be the tip of the spear.
I do want to again thank them for coming in as a sponsor, and it's been really validating because Schamberger and I started these things 3 years ago in the hopes that they could one day make money, and so having that anybody step in and do that, we really appreciate. And we specifically sought them out because it's a great product. I use it a lot. And like, if you're going to buy charcoal, you always regret it if you go with the generic brand over Kingsford. But go ahead, Pat.
So we turn this into a barbecue podcast. That's great.
Ryan's
so
a good advertising partner.
I want to be like Fox. I want to be good partners.
Yeah. So, look, at the end of the day, Amazon and the rest of the tech advertising giants, they have a lot of cash to spend on content. Currently, they don't spend a lot on content, right? So if they're going to step up, there's going to be risk involved from their end. And I understand that people say, well, Amazon has $6 billion in free cash. Well, have you looked at the free cash at AT&T? Have you looked at the free cash at a lot of businesses, right? Just because you have a big check, and Robert alluded to this, doesn't mean you can go get the content. If you're a sports rights holder, promotion, league, conference, you got to ask yourself a lot of questions about if you're going to go with a new partner on a completely different distribution system. Right now you offload tons of risk, execution risk, production risk, financial risk, advertising sales risk. It's all offloaded to a media partner that says, just give me this stuff. I'll do what I do best. You do what you do best, right? If you offload that risk to a new partner who's never really done this on a large scale and just take the money, you are taking some risk. It's a big bet on the future that, quite frankly, despite what the narrative may be in the marketplace, isn't quite as clear as people think it is. It's more an evolution than a revolution. And it's not quite sorted out yet who's going to get destroyed, who's going to get birthed, and who's going to kind of evolve. So there's a lot of marketplace uncertainty. So if you're both a new player and a rights holder of some type, it seems to me to make more sense to do something incremental that's incremental to the current ecosystem that creates value, advances distribution, but doesn't in any way threaten what's going on right now. Rational economic actors rarely have reasons to turn tables over and walk away from a large revenue stream to pivot to a potential future larger revenue stream with nothing in between the middle to bridge it. And some of these all or nothing rights acquisitions narratives could indeed make sense. But I think that I'd really have to have them explained to me. Because right now it seems to me there's plenty of room for rational incrementalism that creates value across the board and doesn't require the kind of risk that some of these bold moves would make or require.
Here's my prediction. I think that Amazon in the next NFL rights deal acquires the Thursday night NFL network exclusive window and therefore has like five or six exclusive Thursday night football
games. I like that. I like that.
That's a great example of it. And probably with that, they could work out a way that it doesn't threaten the NFL network's revenue stream to the NFL. And it doesn't really threaten the current distribution partners. So I like that. That's a creative way to create value and get somebody in.
Okay.
Well, and then, there you go.
PGA Championship going from TNT to ESPN. Another, I guess this is right on the borderline of whether it's premium or the next tier of rights, but nevertheless, it goes to a legacy media outlet and not one of these upstart streaming companies. So any thoughts on that, guys?
I was surprised that it moved only because Turner had it for so long, but I wasn't surprised that it stayed on traditional television outlet versus a streaming package.
I agree with Robert on it staying. I wasn't surprised by it staying on a traditional television package, but I think it's important to understand that we keep talking about, that's an old system versus a new system. I'm sorry, but ESPN and Turner are both new systems, right? All the real innovation occurring in live sports streaming is occurring via the established media companies. It's not really occurring with these kind of advertising platforms that have different types of content on them that have become very valuable, like a Facebook. All the real serious action, the real serious acquisitions, the real serious attempts at programming and reach and experimentation are occurring at the established media companies. And that's because they're now actively engaged. There's a marketplace narrative that says that these new tech companies, if they really are tech companies, they're not Intels. They're something else. They're advertising platforms across digital spaces. And I don't necessarily like that word tech. But that they somehow they're smarter than everybody else. That because they have a lot of money, because they've come into a new marketplace and a new space as first movers, they're immune to competition, which clearly isn't true, I don't think. They're immune to making mistakes, and that there's just a de facto, they're going to figure this out faster than anyone else. Unfortunately, the media companies, the established media companies, have been around for over 100 years, many of them. They've been through everything from vaudeville to silent movies to color and sound to television to VCR, DVDs, and now streaming. In each case, they found a way to lever their content, survive, and evolve. The idea that somehow they don't get a vote seems to be missing a big part of this picture. That doesn't mean that the tech companies or whatever we want to call them don't also participate and create value and figure it out. But the idea that somehow you just write off a Disney, which a lot of people were doing 18 months ago, it seems to me to not make a lot of sense. And into this context of live streaming rights, ESPN with their Plus product and Bleacher Report on Turner, and there's a few other examples, that's where the action is. So if you're a forward-looking rights holder, like the PGA, you don't need to embrace a lot of crazy, a lot of riskier new systems. Your current partners are figuring it out on their own. Why would you take that risk?
There's not much you can argue with there. So final thing, prediction on where the Fox Sports RSNs go to in the Disney sale. I'll go first. I predict they go back to Fox. And I've talked about this a little bit privately with Patrick. He doesn't dispute my overall prediction, but he does dispute some of my ideas. I just think the lengths at which Fox has gone to continue to intertwine these RSNs with their branding and their marketing and their strategy, in my opinion, makes me think that they have a good idea that they are getting them back. I've been on this for months privately, as he will confirm, before anybody else was saying they might get them back, although I did not say it publicly, much to my eternal regret. Pat, where do you think they're going?
Well, I do think that Fox, it makes the most strategic sense for Fox to reacquire them. I also think that it's really important when you ask yourself who can get these is understand who is the person that, who is the entity internally that can justify the most economics, right, to put forward for this. And when you think about it, it's clearly Fox. They understand these businesses. They know how to lever them as part of a portfolio. They've been managing from years for years. The talent that's been developed there is all theirs and internal. So when you think about what they're putting together a model for a bid, they're going to be able to put a large multiple behind this because they know how to hit that number, right? They can make it work. So I think that they probably have to be considered the front runner. That said, you need to think about what Disney's trying to get out of this. It's my understanding that Disney doesn't want to sell off this thing piecemeal. That they, if they could, they'd get rid of all of them at once and be done with it, right? And not be left with any stragglers or anything like that. So if you think about this auction or whatever we want to call it, the first phase of this, if that's right, that Disney wants to get them all out the door to the same bidder somehow or get them out the door cleanly, that takes a lot of people off the table. It takes a lot of people off the table. Now, it doesn't mean that there won't be a second auction after somebody acquires them that tries to split them up to generate value. But it takes a lot of people off the table because you're going to need $30 billion to move this number, to move those things out of there. So who can do that? And so that's what I would say about this.
Bob, where do you think they go?
It's a clean sweep. I'm going to predict Fox, too, as the front runner. And the only thing that I add that didn't already get said is it seemed pretty clear to me that, you know, that Rupert and Disney are going to try and have the best kind of relationship that they can have. And so, therefore, if Fox wants the RSNs back, that just seems to make the most sense to me.
Okay, guys, this is very fun. I really appreciate taking time out of your busy days. Once again, that's Bob Seidman from Sports TV Ratings at Sports TV Ratings on Twitter, sportstvratings.com. That's Pat Craigs, former Fox Sports executive and now a media consultant. You can find him on Twitter at Aquinas82nd. And you know who's going to be really happy with this podcast is Kathy Connors, because we did not talk about daytime studio shows for 1 second.
That's pretty amazing. That's congratulations.
All right, thanks, guys. Appreciate it. Have a good one.
Touch time.